The U.S. Supreme Court is back in session and hearing arguments on the legal issues of our time. From SDPB, today is Thursday, October 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Mike Thompson back to the program. We'll talk about the questions before the bench, including if a judge says a defendant can't talk with lawyers overnight, is that a violation of the Sixth Amendment? If officers wait 40 minutes to enter a home without a warrant, did they believe the man inside was in imminent danger? And is talk therapy free speech or conduct? And how will that impact conversion therapy in the U.S.? But first, we get to know Casey Crabtree, Republican candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. State Senator Casey Crabtree is a Republican from Madison, South Dakota, and now he is running for U.S. House of Representatives. He's the second to announce his candidacy after current Attorney General Marty Jackley, who we had on the show last month. I spoke with Casey Crabtree about his platform, why he's running, and his political priorities.
Of course, the announcement came here a while ago where Dusty Johnson was leaving the U.S. House seat and running for governor. That opens up that seat. And what I have noticed is that out in Washington, D.C., South Dakota needs a good, hard, conservative fighter to go stand with President Trump and help deliver on the America First agenda. I've been doing this for the last 5 years since Kristi Noem asked me to serve in the state Senate. And we've worked on making sure that we push through and deliver to the governor the things that matter most. And that's exactly what we'll do when we get to D.C. Those are things like creating a stronger economy, making sure there's more opportunities for our youth. And that is making sure that we cut taxes and support our farmers and ranchers. Those are things that we've been delivering for the last 5 years. And those are the things that we'll deliver when we get to Congress.
Tell me a little bit about what you think you have to offer versus any other conservative Republican, because a lot of people say that they're there to support the president and to move his agenda forward. A lot of people say they're strong conservatives. So why Casey Crabtree?
Well, it just goes back to the things that we've actually accomplished. You know, I come from the little town of Arlington. I'm raised by blue-collar parents, and around our table, we didn't talk a lot about politics. We talked about business. We talked about work. We talked about faith. We talked about family. And so when I look at, but my dad, he taught me this. He taught me that it's about what you've done that really matters, not what you say you'll do that matters. And so when we look at the things that we've accomplished, that's what I'm talking about. So in the last 5 years, we've focused on some of the things that matter most. Right now, the economy is the number one issue in South Dakota, the number one issue in the country. My background's in economic development. I'm a businessman, a family man, and my wife and I own businesses together. Now, when I look at what's happening in South Dakota, 1 in 5 South Dakotans are delinquent on their credit card debt. This is because interest rates are too high. This is because inflation is too high, all created from 4 years under the Biden economy. Now, when I look at what we've done here, is the things that I've led, such as the housing, the affordable housing work that we've done. That was a bill that I carried in the Senate and delivered, make sure that we had more affordable housing in Sioux Falls, Rapid City, and every rural community in between. I led the way on the state's largest tax cut. That put more money in people's pockets and sent less back to the government. And I also led the way on tuition freezes, making sure that it was more affordable for our kids and our grandkids to go to school here in South Dakota and live their dream right here. Now, some of the other things that I've focused on have been making sure that we've created stronger borders, safer communities. And these are things I've actually worked through the process, Lori, and delivered to the governor. And that's what makes the difference between myself and anybody else that's in the race.
Can you be specific about something that you've done that has helped create stronger borders?
When we look at stronger borders and safer communities overall, I visited down there, visited the border 2 years ago and saw some of the devastation firsthand, saw what human trafficking, drug trafficking was doing to that area, but also understood that the things that come across that border also reached our communities in under a day. So two things that I would point out for you, Lori. One, I brought a ban on sanctuary cities. We've seen the destruction of some of those policies in places like Minnesota, California, Illinois. Those things will never come to South Dakota. We'll never have those issues. The second thing is when we look at what's coming across that border, fentanyl has been devastating across the country, but certainly to South Dakota. I heard a story from a young mother here in the Madison area who lost her daughter to fentanyl. I brought a bill along with now Judge Wheeler, who was in the Senate at the time, to make sure we had the strongest penalties on the books when these dealers come into South Dakota and deal poison to our kids. And so proud to take that and proud to make sure that we're protecting our communities and our kids.
So let's go back to the economy. Tell me a little bit about how you're listening. Like, are you going out to communities? Are you sitting around with people at their kitchen table? And if so, what are they telling you specifically about their concerns with the economy?
Yes. So my background's in economic development. I work in South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska to make sure that we start businesses and those businesses thrive. Those businesses that are already here have an opportunity to stay here and thrive here and help communities grow. And that's what I've been doing my entire life. And outside of that, we are business people as well. So we understand some of the challenges that folks face. We understand what it's like to write a payroll check each month. And I go out and talk to folks professionally. I've done that for a decade, but I also do that politically when we go talk to folks. They're feeling the squeeze over the last 4 years. And again, that is based on a lot of the bad policies that I think came from the Biden administration. Higher interest rates, higher inflation are really pinching people. And folks are telling me about it every day. I go to the grocery store. We've got two boys that are in school here in Madison. I go visit with those folks and, I'll be shopping there and I can see folks putting things back when they go to the grocery store, things that are too expensive. So people are feeling it absolutely everywhere. They're looking for a stronger economy overall. That's the number one issue. Again, one in five are delinquent on their credit card debts here in South Dakota. That tells you how bad the economy has been. Now, things are heading in the right direction. I think working families tax cut is going to put a lot of relief forward for folks here coming up next year when we start to realize those things. But people are looking for more money in their pockets and less the government. That is exactly what I've delivered over the last 5 years here at the state level, and that's exactly what we'll deliver when we go to Congress.
Are President Trump's tariffs and the tariff policies slowing down the relief from inflation?
When we look at the tariffs, I think what's really important to pay attention to there, Lori, is the tariffs are ultimately all about getting better trade deals overall. We have to have sustainable markets, sustainable trade deals for the future. And the tariffs are the leverage that the president is using to do that. I mean, really, when you look at it, I think President Trump is pushing back on some of the bad actors. And what it's going to do is it's going to help American workers and American businesses in the long run. That's going to give us the sustainability that we need moving forward. So it's about better trade deals. It's about protecting American workers and making better opportunities. And that's the lever that the president is pulling. And he's a great deal maker. He's made his life doing that as an economic developer. He's a developer himself. I'm an economic developer. So I look forward to staying with President Trump and making sure we're getting stronger trade deals, better trade deals, and making sure that we've got a sustainable future.
So a lot of farmers we talked to during President Trump's first administration were very supportive of his policies, but they do want the markets back. And some of those soybean markets especially have not come back. Same farmers that I've talked to during this administration, still supportive of the president, but really struggling with soybeans that are in the field, that they're paying to store, that they don't have a place to store, and their patience is wearing thin with that. How can those markets be reopened? What would you tell the president if he was asking you to help develop the policy?
Well, I talk to those farmers every single day. Was just with a friend of mine, Dave, that farms in this area here. He was telling me about the pain he feels running across his soybean fields. It's one of his great joys to harvest. And this year he's looking at about a $60 to $70 per acre loss. And that hits hard, and it hits especially hard when you're talking to a younger farmer, and they see storm clouds there. So it's real, it's real pain, and that impacts not only our farm communities, it impacts our rural communities, it impacts all of South Dakota. Now, I think it's been very clear the president is working to make sure that China gives us a fair trade deal. They've been a bad actor and they've been mistreating our American farmers for decades. We are finally pushing back. And I like that. They've been bullying us. The president's pushing back against the bullies. And I like that. I think that's going to make a difference for our farmers in the long term. So, what do we really need to accomplish? One, we need to make sure that that China's held accountable and that they treat us fair on those deals. The next thing that the president, I think, is working really well on is creating new trade deals. You know, just a reminder, under the Biden administration, there was no new trade deals done, and there was no farm bill passed. And so we're seeing the president work towards new trade deals as well, so access to new markets. And then lastly, I think one thing that's extremely important is, you know, I just spoke at the High Plains Processing grand opening down in Mitchell. That facility will take soybeans here and crush about 30 million bushels per year. That is absolutely fantastic. That gives us more markets here. That's something that I've worked on professionally my entire career, and that is something that we'll do in Congress as well, which is make sure that we've got additional markets here. And so, president's doing a great job resetting the trade deals that were out there and making sure that those are fair for American farmers. He's working hard on making sure that we've got new trade deals. That is something that I look forward to standing with him on and making sure that we get those things done. And third, we're talking about new markets here. And that comes with the farm bill getting that passed.
Which we have zero progress toward a new farm bill, right? Even in President Trump's administration.
I wouldn't say that. I think they're on their way through. They've had some bigger things that they've had to take on here early on in their first 9 months. But in 4 years underneath Biden, they never once made it, got a farm bill accomplished. We are much further along here in 9 months than what they accomplished 4 years. And so I feel very optimistic that Leader Thune will be able to move that through on the Senate side. I look forward to getting to Congress to make sure we get a farm bill done that works for South Dakota farmers and make sure that they're getting a fair shake and that they're not just profitable, they can thrive for the future. And, you know, as somebody with young kids, everything I look forward to, Lori, is making sure that there's better opportunities for our kids and grandkids. And that's one place that we can start to make a difference.
We talked a lot about your leadership successes. Of course, your opponents will bring up a fairly public leadership failure, is how they'll position it. And I'm kind of curious to know how you position it with Senate Bill 201. You lost your leadership position. That bill was overturned at the ballot box. It was very contentious. Tell us a little bit about how you think of that experience for you as a political leader.
Well, when I look at that issue in general, I look at that as part of President Trump's energy dominance issue. The president's been very clear that energy dominance is the way to lower costs for consumers all the way across the spectrum. It's also a way to bolster our corn growers and make sure that folks pay less at the pump. And so we took on that challenge this last year, tried to put together something that settled that. The majority of the legislature agreed with that. Again, 100% in line with President Trump's agenda. Governor Noem quickly signed that. But folks disagreed with the way that that bill read. And that's something that I respect from the people at home. And so, for me, we'll stay focused on things that are about the energy dominance, making sure that those lower costs for folks at home. And at the end of the day, Lori, I'll never stop fighting for farmers and ranchers. And that's what we'll stay focused on, and making sure that folks can thrive and the economy is strong here in South Dakota going forward.
Is there anything you would do differently, looking back?
You know, we were faced with a very difficult deal to try to put together that whole deal. And again, I'll never apologize for fighting for farmers and ranchers, making sure we're bolstering the economy, making sure that we're lowering energy prices, and that we are working with folks to deliver on that. We'll stay in line with President Trump's agenda on those types of deals and continue to work towards making sure that we make South Dakota a stronger place for the future.
You are entering, and we'll wrap up here. You've been generous with your time, but I'm curious, as I follow you on X slash Twitter and other social media platforms, you're entering as a family man a political environment that can be very contentious. How do you go home and talk to your kids and your family about what's going to be happening on social media, how you measure your words, how you behave with integrity in the public square? When is it tough talk? When is it below the belt hitting? When your kids come to you with questions about that, how are you going to respond as a father?
Well, you're right. My most important duties are as a husband and father. And the rest of things come after that, right? It's faith and it's family, and then it's our work from there. And so we have lots of these discussions with our kids about doing things the right way. And the reason we're serving and doing the things we're doing is to make sure that we create more opportunities, a better life for this generation and the next. And so we will hold ourselves to the highest integrity, the highest at all times. We'll work really hard, and we'll continue to stay in the fight to make sure that we make a difference for the future of kids here in South Dakota. And so we have those discussions. I'm proud of those two boys and the work that they've done here as they're getting educated. I'll have one that goes to college next year, and it's exciting times for us. They are playing every sport underneath the sun. They work hard in school, and we make sure that we have these discussions with them to let them know that we're going to do things the right way. We're going to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And although that politics can be a nasty world, social media can be a nasty world, that's not who we are. We're serving to try to make a difference for all South Dakotans.
That was State Senator Casey Crabtree. He is now running for South Dakota's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Voting in that primary is set for next June. Up next, the U.S. Supreme Court began its latest term this month. Mike Thompson will cover the first few cases that caught his eyes after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court heard the first few arguments of its new term earlier this month. We're turning to our judicial guide for a preview of the cases before the highest court in the land. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. A new term of the U.S. Supreme Court has begun, and we're already hearing arguments and already inferring things about what this court is going to decide from the questions that are being made. So we're going to go over some cases today.
Yes.
Let's start with this Sixth Amendment. Quick pop quiz. What's in the Sixth Amendment, listeners?
Should we wait for an answer?
Yeah, or, pause.
Okay.
Okay, tell us.
All right. The Sixth Amendment has a number of rights that apply when a criminal prosecution starts or a criminal proceeding starts against a person. One of those is you have the right to effective assistance of counsel for your defense. That's in the Sixth Amendment, along with another number of other rights that apply at trial, trial stages. So this one, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, is the issue. This is from the highest court in the state of Texas who decided it. Interesting case. The defendant, Villarreal, is on trial. He decides he's going to testify on his own behalf. Mm-hmm. And I think it's before we get into
the murder trial. Yep.
Before we get into the actual Sixth Amendment discussion, it's pretty rare for a defendant to choose to testify on his own behalf because of if he's got prior convictions, he can be cross-examined about those, and he's not he or she or they are not seasoned at testifying like law enforcement. Okay. So,
and a whole lot is at stake.
A whole lot is at stake, yeah. So he's testifying on his behalf. He's got lawyers. He starts his testimony at about, the judge tells the parties that, hey, we got to adjourn at 1 o'clock because I got some administrative stuff to do. And so Villarreal takes a stand at about noon. and we get to 1 o'clock, and we the judge calls the recess, and the judge says to the defendant's lawyers, well, we're going to have this overnight recess. You cannot talk to your client about his testimony. So he's forcing the lawyers not to talk to their client, but he limits it to only about his testimony. He doesn't want the lawyers coaching the defendant about what he said or what he should say, those kinds of things. And
the lawyers accept that at the time of trial? Is there a, hey, we object to that, Your Honor, or is there some clarity provided at that point?
Yeah, they ask clarifying questions. The attorneys do, like, what does that mean? What can we talk about? Can we talk about trial strategy? Those types of things. And the judge says, yeah, you can talk about those things. You just cannot talk about his testimony with him. Because the judge likened it to, if the guy was on the witness stand testifying, the lawyers could not coach him during his testimony.
Come over here. Yeah, let's coach you and then go back on. There's no timeout.
Right.
Except what's the important part about the overnight and lawyers having access to him to talk about the case?
Yeah, there are two U.S. Supreme Court cases. One, the court, during a 15-minute recess in a criminal trial, the court said you can't talk to your client. And then the other one was an overnight recess, and the judge said, you can't talk to your client about anything. You can't have access to your client overnight. In the 15-minute case, the Supreme Court said that was no Sixth Amendment violation. In the overnight case, the Supreme Court said it was a Sixth Amendment violation. So here we've sort of got the split the baby situation where, yeah, we got an overnight. Yeah, you can talk to him, just not about his testimony.
Oh, I see. Okay. He's convicted.
Yeah.
And then he takes his appeal, and the appeal goes up to the Supreme Court. And the reason they accept the case is presumably what you just said, and the fact that there's conflicting precedents.
Conflicting cases. We need some sort of rule to guide this. And in a criminal trial, before that defendant testifies, of course the lawyers are going to talk to him about, here are the possible cross-examination questions.
Yeah.
How are you going to answer those? I mean, it's not... They can't coach him necessarily, tell him what to say, but they can help him understand the process and what's going to happen while he's testifying.
So help me understand then, he is arguing under the Sixth Amendment. Help me understand the Sixth Amendment argument. Is he just saying, like, we were not allowed to talk and that caused my conviction because, you know, or is he saying, you know, the fact that we ran into this time crunch and then we got ourselves in a situation where we couldn't talk. That was ineffective counsel. What's his Sixth Amendment argument?
The argument is the judge denied him the assistance of counsel by saying you can't talk to him about his testimony.
Okay. So he's not saying his counsel was poor. He's saying the judge didn't let him have access to them.
Excellent point. Yeah, most of the time when you're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, it is my attorney wasn't any good.
Okay.
But this isn't that case.
All right.
Yeah.
Has this been heard already? It's been argued.
Yeah, it's been argued.
Any insight from the arguments?
Well, I didn't get a chance to hear the arguments. I could forecast. I think that what the court's going to say, if a lawyer coaching a witness, that is an ethical matter, and I think the trial court could just leave that to the attorney to decide. And the judge did that in this case. He was just trusting the lawyers not to talk about the testimony. But there are other things you can talk to him about and need to talk to him about, like if there's a plea bargain that's still open, other trial strategy.
So then do they have to overturn a previous case? Or can they just say, what are their options? What are the U.S. Supreme Court's options for a decision? Really going against precedent? Or are they just looking at this case as a unique case that doesn't...
Yeah, I think they're looking at this case as we have to have... We can't base this on the length of the recess. We need to base this on the merits of what the lawyers are going to talk about. Or do we have an absolute rule that you can't ban lawyers from talking to their client?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we have some other rule that takes into consideration certain factors.
Is there a reason that this one is of particular interest to you? What makes this case so fascinating?
The Sixth Amendment. It's pretty rare to see a Sixth Amendment issue that's not brought up post-conviction.
Yeah. All right, let's dive into some cases of the times. And this is Childs v. Salazar. Right. Also has already been argued.
Yep.
And this is about a counselor in Colorado Springs who wants to do conversion therapy. And there's a Colorado law that bans that. And she says that violates my free speech rights because right. I'm a talk therapist.
Right. And my, yeah, free speech and free exercise of religion.
Okay.
If you go, the counselor in this case has a website that you can go to. I think it's called Deeper Stories. And the website has, it mentions faith and being grounded in faith and things. Yeah, so Colorado has a law that prevents engaging in conversion therapy of a minor. So it's not, this is not just I'm talking to them about their desire to convert, go through conversion therapy, or their desire to be transgender or whatever. This is about I'm actually conducting the therapy. I'm actually advocating the conversion because you want to.
Yeah.
So the she brings.
Does she have standing? Has anyone sued her?
That's a fantastic question. I knew you were going to ask it because that's one of your favorite legal issues. That does take up.
Not just anybody can come in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Exactly. Yeah. the court spends a good 5 to 10 pages talking about the standing issue and mm-hmm. does and says she has standing because it could possibly affect her license if she does engage in conversion therapy.
So it's chilling her practice is what she's arguing.
Excellent.
I'm not doing this because I'm afraid, but no one's actually actively sued her.
Right. Okay. Nobody has. And so she asks for a preliminary injunction, which is a court order mm-hmm. saying you can't enforce the statute against her. I think it's important to know that the case is in that posture. This is a very preliminary, as the name implies, a very preliminary action in the litigation.
Sure.
And she has to show to be entitled to this equitable remedy of injunction where the court stops enforcement. One of the things she has to show is that she has a likelihood of success on the merits, that it's likely that she would win on her constitutional argument that this statute violates her, one of the two or both, free speech and free exercise. So the case goes to the trial court in the federal system, the district court. And then it goes to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Tenth Circuit says that she doesn't have any likelihood of success on the merits, that this statute regulates conduct with only an incidental effect on speech. It doesn't regulate.
Because it's a treatment.
Right.
She's not standing on the corner or posting on her website her beliefs about transgender people. She is treating them with a approved or not approved, in this case, according to the state method of care.
Right.
Do I understand that?
Yep.
Okay.
So the Tenth Circuit, which is the court, the appeal comes to the U.S. Supreme Court from the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit says you're not going to succeed, or it's unlikely you're going to succeed on the merits because the statute is just regulating conduct. It's mm-hmm. not regulating speech. There might be an impact on your speech, but it's incidental. The Supreme Court, In setting up the issue, because the Supreme Court will publish, if you go to its calendar, you can click on the case, and the Supreme Court publishes the questions presented for argument.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court, in setting it up, said that this is a content-based statute, which is a term of art in First Amendment law. If it's content-based, then that means it's very likely unconstitutional. We're going to have to engage in strict scrutiny to determine the constitutionality. And that involves the government having a compelling interest in regulating the activity, and they take a narrow approach to the regulation.
So Colorado will have to prove that they have an interest in protecting children from harmful therapy, which is conversion therapy in their mind.
Right. If the U.S. Supreme Court says that, no, this doesn't regulate conduct, this regulates speech, then that's what the government's going to have to prove. But the Supreme Court, the most they need to do, if that's their belief, the most they need to do is say, no, we're going to reverse the Tenth Circuit, grant the preliminary injunction, and then the litigation can continue in the trial court. And at the trial court level, that's where Colorado would have to come in and show that they have a compelling interest in regulation and they have a narrowly tailored approach.
So one of the interesting things about this, because obviously this is highly politically charged, is just this idea of medical expertise that comes up in the argument. So tell us a little bit about how in the arguments justices revealed their thoughts about research, science, and what both parties were presenting as the facts of whether this treatment is harmful and whether there's evidence of that treatment being harmful.
I don't think that now's the time to make those arguments, and I don't think they should be made. The court at this point is not passing on the merits of the case. The court at this time at the injunction stage should just be determining is she likely to succeed? Not yeah, she's going to succeed. Is she likely to succeed?
But can't they throw out the whole law? They can throw out the law.
They can. And maybe this is a personal opinion, but the Supreme Court's got a bunch of gatekeeping functions, one of which is to you decide a case on the narrowest issue possible.
Okay.
And just saying that this law is unconstitutional without giving Colorado the chance to match the strict scrutiny test, if the court determines it's content-based, I think that would be wrong.
Okay.
But you're right. They can do pretty
much. So what did you hear from the arguments about whether or not they felt that it needed to face the strict scrutiny test? Because they can also, what are their options here, I guess?
Yeah, their options are to say the law is unconstitutional. I don't think procedurally the case is in the position for that. Their other option, if they disagree with the law, is to say we're granting the injunction. You can't enforce it. And
then she still has to go forward.
She still has to put on her proof.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Anything else on Childs?
No, it's just our present court seems very open to free exercise and free speech claims, especially in this kind of an area.
But isn't the question here is whether or not this is free speech because it's a medical treatment?
Right. Right.
She's arguing it's free speech because all I do is speech. I mean, I'm giving my viewpoint to these clients, and you're keeping clients from coming to me for that viewpoint, which they're seeking out. And Colorado's saying, no, this is a very dangerous method of treatment that we know as therapists is not supported by the research, which she disputes.
It's sort of like Scarametti from last term, where the transgender case about giving the puberty blockers and things and the law that prevented that. Here you've got a law preventing the conversion
therapy. Yeah.
And both cases involve minors. So
yeah, all right.
It'll be interesting to watch which way they go on that one.
There's more to this conversation. Stick around after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's return to our conversation with Mike Thompson. He is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joined me with a summary of the United States Supreme Court's first few arguments this term. All right, now we're going to head over to Case v. Montana.
Yeah, the criminal stuff, of course, is, in my opinion, the most fun. This is an interesting one. This case is about the emergency aid exception to the Fourth Amendment. So precursor, the Fourth Amendment prevents unreasonable searches and seizures. General rule is I have to have a warrant. If I don't have a warrant for the search or the seizure, it's unreasonable. The court has developed a number of exceptions to that warrant requirement. One of them is emergency aid. So back in 2006, the court said that the police can enter a home without a warrant when they have an objectively reasonable basis for believing that an occupant is seriously injured or imminently threatened with such injury. In the case versus Montana, Case was in a status that nobody wants to be in, which is that he is known to law enforcement because he's ran into them before. He's drunk. He's got guns. Dangerous guy. The officers know him. they get a call from his ex-girlfriend that he's Case has threatened suicide. So they go to the home to conduct essentially a wellness check to see. He's saying that he's going to commit suicide. She relates that she thought she heard a cocking pistol. Police get there. They look in the picture window, and they can see an empty holster, a pad of paper. So they're starting to think that maybe he is going to commit suicide. But they wait. They wait about 40 minutes before they go in because of the danger this guy presents because of his affinity for weapons when he's drinking. So they finally go in, and they're going through the house. They're announcing their presence. The case whips open a closet curtain. One of the officers thinks he has a gun, so he shoots him in the stomach, and then he's taken into custody. So the question is whether.
And they find a handgun in a laundry hamper
did.
Next to where he fell down.
That's exactly right.
The whole story. So.
Yeah. What, do you think I'm leaving out facts?
No.
Oh.
I just thought that was an important little.
It is a fact. Yeah, it's an important fact. Yeah. It is an important fact.
So Case's argument is they should have never come in the first place.
Right. Yep, I didn't. No crime has been committed. You can't come into my house. And the jurisprudence is real clear that the house is the most private place.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court protects the home. There was a couple years ago, there was a case called Strom versus Coniglia where the guy threatened suicide. They took him into custody and took him to behavioral health or someplace on an involuntary commitment. They came back to the house and took his guns into custody. Mm. And the court said you couldn't do that under the emergency aid doctrine because at that time it wasn't objectively reasonable that there was imminent harm.
Yeah.
But here, at least it's arguable that there was an objectively reasonable basis for believing that.
What about this 40 minutes?
Yeah, that's a good
they didn't race in.
Part of the
they
totality
look,
of the
They see
circumstances.
What they believe is some evidence that there's an empty holster, what they believe is a suicide note, empty beer cans, but they don't go racing in. They wait 40 minutes. Is that not enough time to get a warrant?
That's a great question because you can get warrants fairly quickly in today's world by phone sometimes, depending on the statutory law of the jurisdiction.
That's what Case is going to argue.
And the objectively reasonable part, one of the circumstances the court's going to have to consider is the 40-minute gap. Does that deteriorate from the emergency nature of the call?
What's at stake here is that the evidence, the facts that I laid out, there was a gun in a hamper, that doesn't show up in a trial then if they entered, because he shot an officer. So he's going to get charged with that, and he's saying.
Yeah, he's charged with assault.
So there's a lot at stake here. Yeah.
So then the gun would be thrown, thrown out as evidence if the search was unreasonable. One more point about it, which makes it really interesting, I think. Case is arguing, is that not only do you have to have an objectively reasonable basis to come in on an emergency, but you also have probable cause. You also have to show probable cause to believe the emergency is happening. The term objectively reasonable is used in use of force cases. And uses of force to conduct seizures are constitutional as long as they're objectively reasonable. And so that sometimes that objectively reasonable phrase subsumes probable cause. So there's some nature of a probable cause determination in determining whether something is objectively reasonable. So it's an example of a court's use of terms that can make outcomes confusing.
All right.
Isn't it fun?
And this has not been decided by other cases. This is unique in what way? This seems like something that would come up all the time.
Yeah, this is, you've got this 2006 Brigham City of Utah versus Stewart that set forth the principle. You can't, if it's an objectively reasonable basis to go in, that's all you need. And the court will have to determine whether. Yeah.
And what's at stake is the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, what's at stake is the Fourth Amendment, exactly.
Yeah.
And we don't want that injured.
No.
The Fourth Amendment. No.
All right. Here we go. Let's get into the one of the most contentious issues of our political times is women's sports.
Women's,
and
yes.
You and I have been talking about this for a couple of years as laws started being passed in 2020 and 2022 in South Dakota, I believe it was 2022, that we kind of knew some of these cases were going to end up in the Supreme Court. Some of these laws were going to be challenged.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So in South Dakota, it's the 2022 Senate Bill 46, an act to protect fairness in women's sports, essentially saying transgender girls cannot play on female sports teams is the
right
crux of it. That's right. A generalization of these right different laws. It's not a South Dakota case
no
in the Supreme Court, but it's Idaho. Tell me a little bit about what's happening with Little v. Hecox.
Yes.
H-E-C-O-X.
That's the one that comes out of Idaho. That involves mm-hmm an adult student athlete
okay
who wants to participate on a team. The West Virginia versus BPJ is a 14-year-old girl who wants to...
So two cases here. Yeah.
So
all right.
Two cases together.
Mm-hmm.
These haven't been set for argument yet.
Okay.
So we'll have to...
At the time we're recording this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to wait and see when they're going to be. But so these cases are brought under Title IX, which is part of the United States Code, that says you can't discriminate. An entity receiving federal financial assistance cannot discriminate based on sex. Title VII is another part of the Civil Rights Act that applies in employment and says you can't discriminate based on sex. The U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the word sex in Title VII to include transgender status, which is interesting. And there are a lot of cases that in which the court will use Title VII principles and interpretations to guide its interpretation of the way the word sex is used in other federal statutes.
Okay.
So if they follow that, there's going to be a Title IX problem in these cases, that there's a violation of Title IX because you're discriminating based on sex.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first claim is that statutory claim that may or may not be a deciding factor in the cases. They're also brought under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So sex is a suspect class.
Mm-hmm.
You got to treat people equally.
You're telling me I cannot play in this team solely based on my transgender status. Therefore, you're discriminating against me based on sex.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So the constitutional standard, the equal protection standard, will require if the court says, yep, this is discrimination based on sex, then we're back to the old strict scrutiny test where the state has to present a compelling interest that they're trying to regulate. And that this way of regulation is the narrowest,
mm-hmm.
But you don't have to show that under Title IX. You don't. Title IX is a different thing than the Equal Protection Clause, obviously.
So let's talk about some of the facts. So this the Idaho case is a transgender woman who wants to join the cross country team, the women's cross country team,
yep.
Files suit alongside a cisgender high school student. Saying both of them are saying it violates their rights. One because presumably because she has to have a mandatory medical verification
right
of her anatomy.
Right.
That's how
exactly
we're going to say that.
Yeah.
So very they're both good suing. And then in the West Virginia case, we have a cisgender girl, a minor, yeah, who took medication took puberty blockers, and now wants to play in an athletic team. And was banned from doing it.
Right.
Because she was assigned male at birth.
Yep.
Strict scrutiny, the state will have to prove, those states, West Virginia and Idaho, will have to prove that they enacted these laws to protect something and someone. In this case, they're going to say, we are protecting the women who are playing sports. We're protecting girls' sports. That's their argument, right?
Right.
Protecting, I mean, again, broadly speaking,
the integrity of women's sports, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And it has to be narrow. Help me understand that.
Right. So, but this is only under the Equal Protection Clause now.
Okay.
So if the court's going to consider the equal protection argument, and they accept, they have to first accept that this is a classification based on sex. In Scarametti, remember, they said that statute was not classifying based on sex.
Mm,
it was based on medical care.
Right.
So if under the equal protection part, if they say this is based on sex, then the government has to show that, no, wait a minute, we've got a compelling interest mm-hmm. that we're regulating here. And if that compelling interest is integrity of women's sports or competitiveness, I don't know what it would be. And the way we're choosing to regulate it mm-hmm. by denying her participation is the narrowest way to achieve our interest. It's not too broad. It's not going to affect a whole bunch of people other than people like this plaintiff.
Right. So then what are they protecting the integrity of sports from? Does that matter? Because some of the arguments I'm hearing is like, oh, from not getting a scholarship or from, you know, you're making it so these transgender athletes are coming in is the argument, and somehow they're superior athletes. And now this girl who has trained, this cisgender girl who's trained her whole life, now she can't have this. And that is one of the arguments I've heard, but that's never necessarily tied to an outcome. So do they have to say, I mean, are they going to be in the position where they have to narrowly define it based on you can participate, but you can't win?
Yeah, they're going to have to, the state is going to have to.
Or you can't get a scholarship, or you can't. I mean, there are other ways to narrow the law, aren't there?
Well.
Than just saying nobody can play.
It's not, it wouldn't be a narrowing of the law. It's a narrowing of the government's approach. So they would have to say, okay, here's our interest. Our interest is protecting women's sports from competition, unfair competition.
Sure.
And so to do that, we have to do these three things. We're going to do these three things or two things or whatever it is. And the court's going to look at, first the court's going to look at whether the interest is compelling. And if the court does get to the equal protection analysis on this, the government's going to lose. They're not going to be able to show a compelling interest. That's if the court gets to that this is a classification under the Equal Protection Clause based on sex. The interesting part is this also this Title IX argument, because mm-hmm. I'm not sure how the court is going to go from a Title VII analysis that says transgender status is sex and then go to a Title IX situation and say the transgender status is not sex.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how they do that.
Which court determined the Title VII? Is it the same makeup of the court?
Yes, that was the Bostock case a few years ago. Yeah, with that, and Gorsuch wrote that opinion.
Okay,
so it was it was really close, 5-4, I think, on that. So. We'll see.
So do you think there's a good chance these get struck down as violations of?
If I had to forecast, I don't think
the crystal ball. Yeah.
From the equal protection side, I don't think the court's going to find that these are regulations based on sex.
Say that again?
From the equal protection side, uh-huh. I don't think the court's going to find that these are classifications based on sex. If they do find that it's sex discrimination under Title IX, there are ways to address that aren't subject to strict scrutiny. So I don't know. I don't have much hope in the equal protection claim, especially based on Scarametti and how the court has handled that in the past. I am interested if they deal with the Title IX issue, how they're going to analyze that.
That's Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and R. Youngeman. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. We thank you for listening.